we were talking about the some of the rules and practices in the prison there.
Yes, we just picked up on that I would have to rule on that claim whether he was really sick or not. And it was a game between the doctor and the prisoners, more or less. And you had to walk pretty circumspectly, and you could not have any favorites inside the walls, otherwise your life would be in danger. And they soon learned that I had no favorites, and I was able to survive the 18 months. Anyway, this would be, as the law said, from cant or can't, sun up to sundown. And they would try everything. For example, here would come this prisoner line, and going back to this tall black from Memphis, he was my assistant over there. This man would come in and say, "Doc, I've got a fever." What he had done, he'd stand outside in the hall, and there's a hot water spigot out there in a laboratory, in hot and cold, and he would hold hot water in his mouth, just as hot as he could stand it, and come in. And Joe Lee would stick a thermometer in his mouth, 104, but his pulse, just as smooth, you go to work. Another would come in and frame his back, down in the back. That's a hard one. I might drop my stethoscope or something, he'd reach down to pick it up. I know I sent a lot of them to work not feeling good, and a lot of them, they would fool me, but it was a game, and as long as you played it fair, it was okay. But I had one white boy. He was, I think he was 22. I've forgotten what he was in. He was in for a year and a day. And he made the boast when he came in. We took 2 weeks for us to process, and we'd have to get their history and check their physical and all that. He said he was not going to work. So he didn't. After he got him processed and everything, and was assigned to a cell, now the cell gates fit very tight to where you couldn't get even a knife blade between the lock area. And the morning he was to go to work, he took his little finger right here and put right in the door jamb and slammed the door and cut that tip off. And in the hospital, I had to go back and sew it up. And he had what we call causalgia for 6 months. The nerve endings, he claimed, would hurt, and he didn't work for 6 months. And finally, I was going to have to assign him, he cut the oven off. He didn't work a day.
Well, he paid a heavy price.
He did, but...
Doctor, then after you left Kilby, did you come with the TVA?
Yes. But the one thing that was difficult for the doctor on capital punishment, electrocution.
Oh, yes, you had that in Kilby.
And as I recall, we electrocuted between 10 and 12 during the 18 months I was there. And the law reads, and still reads at this time, that they would be put to death on Friday. And the old oak chair that we used then is still there. Very sturdy. Arms, and of course you put the arms down like this. Strap the legs, strap the arms, strap the body. Shave the head. And use the turtle shell with the back part with a brine sponge and the front part the same. And we would electrocute at 12:01 Thursday night. Normally, if you'd walk inside the walls and go back in after you left for the day, there'd be a constant hum of voices and movement. But that night, you could hear a pin drop. Of course, the prisoners knew what was going on. So I would have to be there, and the warden would have to pull the switch, throw the switch. Now, Georgia, where I had to do the same thing when I was working over there, they had a system whereby three pulled the switch on tumblers. No one knew which one really killed the man. But I'll never forget one white man. I got to where I wouldn't watch the execution. I'd stay beside the door, then go in and check the heart. Frequently, we had to give the second. And then I'd go in. Because no matter how well you fix the electrodes, there'd be a flesh smell. This white man, I'll never forget. We strapped him in, everything. And just before we put this front turtle shell over his face, hooked onto the other one, the chaplain walked up and says, "Mr. So-and-so, do you have any statements you wish to make?" He looks at him and says, "Hell no, I'm tired and sleepy, let's go." Oh, that shook me up. So we'll leave Kilby now and...
On that subject, just for a moment, medically speaking, from a medical standpoint, is electrocution inhumane? Is it instantaneous? Is it? Do you have any ideas about that?
Frankly, we don't know. Now, of course, the electrical linemen who get burns and things, it's painful. But the shock is... But enough shock to kill, you don't get any answers from the man. You don't know. Just like automobile accident in which you are killed. We don't know how much pain is there. And what is pain? Some people, hypersensitive. And you take, this is what we're doing today. This is digressing to the present time. As I described this meeting I attended in Florida back in February, geriatrics meeting, and I was at the board meeting of St. Barnabas yesterday. The terminally ill cancer, pain. We don't cure at the present time. And why let them hurt? You can give narcotics and keep them at a level of half consciousness, free of pain until they die. But who is terminal? Who do you do that to?
Those are the questions.
That's the big questions. In fact, one of the papers at this meeting, which was a national meeting, it's having the East and the West. The West will be next month. A very significant meeting of the very top people in the country on the care of the aging. A young female doctor and a nurse have opened a nursing home in Miami of 25 beds in which they do not attempt any curative measures. All they do is give sufficient drugs to keep that patient floating. And Medicare is paying for 6 months, but they stop at 6 months, expect them to be dead at 6 months. But you're dealing with a very sensitive area. This paper created a lot of discussion at this meeting, about 500 of us there, question and answers. And I think I broke up the meeting there at the end. I asked the simple question, how do you define terminal? We are all terminal.
Well, did your experience there in the in the prison, Doctor, did it leave, you with any feeling about capital punishment per se?
Yes, of course we all, if we be completely honest with ourselves. I observe that nobody wants to die. Shall we say the normal person?
Yes.
Now, the mentally uncontrolled or other conditions which are sufficiently overwhelming to where you don't want to live. Pain. I do think it is a deterrent. That's my feeling. And how much rehabilitation we do in prisons today, I don't know. With the life the way it is outside, in normal life today, with our social life, divorce, broken families, drugs, loyalty to a country, and all of these parades of people, where are we? Back when I was in high school, a rhetoric professor of mine, and I think he had a very good idea, the cycle of nations. If you go back into history, pick up Romans, whatever, you start off at one point in the circle, a democracy, an autocracy, a monarch, a whatnot, and by the time you make the circle, the nation crumbles. That's a fascinating study in history. I wish you'd take it up and write a book on it. But getting back to, yes, I think that an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth is just the thought in the person who's going to commit a crime that he can be killed. I think it makes him think a little.
Well, shall we go to now to the TVA? Your career with the TVA was long and illustrious in the field of medicine, in the medical care. Tell us about the about your beginning with with the agency.
I knew that at Kilby that I was not going to stay there the rest of my life because it was political to start with, and that wasn't quite my objective in life. And I saw an ad in the paper and wrote, that was back in the summer of 1933, wrote to Knoxville, and I got a return reply to come to Knoxville for interview, which I did. I was driving a little Buick with a rumble seat, I'll never forget. And
took you 2 days to get there.
Oh, yes, yeah. And so I met the personnel director, and Gordon Clapp, I don't know whether you ever knew him or not,
yes,
was my assistant, was his assistant. And they took my history and everything, and at that time, we were just starting Norris Dam. They had broken ground there and were organizing. A.E. Morgan and Dr. Morgan and Lilienthal.
Well, the directors.
Were the directors. And so I'd had experience in construction work for the power companies and things like that. And we would have to develop little hospitals at that time for TVA. And because of that experience, I became the medical director of the Health and Safety Department. Dr. E.L. Bishop, who was state health officer, was part-time at that. I was the first full-time doctor that TVA employed. So I go back to Kilby and resign and go up, and my wife, and at that time, our daughter, Betty, was born in prison, you might say, and so she was just a little bit, about 18 months old. So we moved in, and we were in the old post office building there at that time. I had a little office.
This was in Knoxville.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then finally Dr. Bishop came on full time as head of the health and safety. In other words, the health, that was preventive disease and, of course, the safety program. And then my job was to organize the field program, the whole thing. Get the hospitals going and get all that going and everything. I was sitting in my little cubbyhole there one day, and Dr. Bishop sent across my desk a flyer out of Washington. We were the youngest department of the national department at that time. It was a flyer from the post office department for surplus drugs. Here was a whole list of drugs that they could no longer use and the TVA could have just to pay the transportation charges. I looked down that list and there was aspirin, compound cathartic pills which contained calomel and all that kind of stuff, you know, and everything. But still no antibiotics at that time. And I thought, well, yeah, we're going to have hospitals. We can use this stuff free of charge. So I signed it, let it go. And in about 2 weeks, the warehouse called me and said, Doc, your drugs are here. I said, okay, send them up to the office. How big is your office? He said, you've got a half a carload of drugs, railroad car. And that list on the left-hand column where I thought it was bottles was cartons. Well, you never saw as many drugs in your life. And we began to organize and everything like that, you know, and open up for Wheeler Dam, and the dam, Huntsville, Decatur, and all around. And I'd peddle those, I was traveling between those hospitals, and I filled up their little drug rooms. I had made a dent in that thing. And then we moved from Knoxville to Chattanooga.
Well, excuse me, at this stage your work was administrative rather than medical.
Yes, my work, I didn't know what you might call practice at all. I employed it, doctors,
yes,
and supervised the work and supervised the operation of the hospitals and all. But my headquarters was always back at headquarters along with, yes, Dr. Bishop there. And the WPA came along. Works progress. That's when lawyers, other people, had to get work, physical work. And we did one thing, which I don't think was done very much throughout the country. We had a corps of doctors working with us and everything, and so we were able to check those men for any basic problems because they were used to sedentary life and we didn't have physical fitness at that time. And if we put them digging ditches out there at Norwich, they'd die, they'd be killed. And so we had a very successful medical record of those we put to work. Of course, they're so thick out there, they almost hit each other's heels with the picks on each other. Also, the CCC.
Yes.
Well, that was the young people and did a beautiful job. But interesting, one day I was walking up the street and two CCC boys in that typical little uniform walking. Here comes the third one up. And they turn to him. What's your charge? 25 cents to pull over clothes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But anyway.
That was the Civilian Conservation Corps. They did a great job.
They did.
Yes.
They did a great job. Well handled. And WPA, I think, kept some people from getting hungry.
Yeah. They built some lasting monuments, too. Well, in your field hospitals, they were well-constructed units.
Yes, so you take, we had one right out here at Chickamauga. It was a wooden structure.
Yes.
And we had one at Watts Bar up here. That building is now the dining room.
Is that right?
Yeah. It was well-constructed. It was temporary, of course, but well-equipped. And our doctors were practically all young doctors, well trained. You take, I employed O.M. Derryberry at the dam just above Mississippi, just south of
Pickwick.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a good, at Fontana, we had a 75-bed hospital, which is now the business headquarters, and we had pediatrics, surgery, everything there.
Now, they, those doctors and the hospital served the, both the construction workers, or primarily the construction workers and their families.
Both, yes.
Yes.
And as I will, I probably established the first socialized medicine in Tennessee, because at these outpost hospitals, we would, except for on-duty injuries by the workers, a certain amount of money a month to cover their health.
Entire health care.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In other words, if he had a family, it'd be so much, and they could get service in the hospital, or he could get service in the hospital. Mm-hmm. And it worked out very well. And as we moved along with the work, we developed the first mobile unit of its kind in the whole United States. At the time Fontana was started, why, as I've told you before, I think before this, we were working with the siliceous rock for the aggregate for the concrete that Copper Hill and all had so many lawsuits about silicosis and all. Well, we decided that we would check every man's chest that went to work in the quarries when he went to work, so we'd have a baseline on him. And we were some miles away from the Fontana Dam proper with the quarries, and rugged territory up there, as you know. And we would haul a little x-ray machine in the back of a pickup truck out there, and it bounced around and everything. And we tore up two or three, and it would rain. So finally we took a little trailer, flat trailer, and put some pipe over it like this, and put canvas on it, and pulled that out there, but still we had trouble. Well, what the heck with that? Anyway, we had contracted with the General Electric Company for our x-ray equipment for all our hospitals. Mm-hmm. And I was a very close friend of our GE's representative. He was up here in the old post office one day, talking about this. And we said, why don't we get a bus? Like a Greyhound bus. We did, put a water tank in it, put the developing and everything, and put a good chest x-ray. We'd have to take the films back to the hospital to develop them, right there on the job. And that was the first time anywhere that I can find out in this United States where a mobile medical service was provided, like diabetes and things like that, and it happens right up the old post office here. Here.
Right. How long did that unit stay, and did you continue to use it and others like it during?
Well, we didn't need it in our work so much other places, because we didn't have to deal with that, but it was, we did have it one time here, and in Memphis we had diabetes trucks like that, and the health departments used to have those kind of issues.
Yes,
remember? Yeah.
Yes, the mobile units.
Yeah.
But it came out of the, it came out of that bus.
Yeah. No, the quality of service we gave, I'll have to say that the younger doctors, and also we did another service at that time, like Fontana. You had some rural doctors nearby, like the Cherokee Indian in the back in there, and they, we arranged where they could come and work with us, and they could bring patients with us. And the younger doctors brought back to them the newer techniques and everything, and the older doctor gave to the younger doctor what old Dr. Patterson.
Yes.
The science of medicine, Dr. Ian Patterson.
Yes.
And it's not all the pills you give, it's your, confidence and contact with your patient. I still think on Signal Mountain, I did more good listening than I did every pill I gave. One other, go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask, to what extent did, were your, those services available to local people?
No.
Only through contact with the doctor?
That's
that,
correct.
That.
That's, we did not serve other than families or employees.
Yes.
We had no ambition to move out.
No.
But getting back to these drugs, so we moved to Chattanooga. And I very carefully didn't mention to the warehouse we were moving. And in about 3 weeks, the warehouse head called. The doctor, your drugs are here. That was an albatross around my neck. So by that time, we'd pretty well finished up most of the dams. We were building Chickamauga at the time. We'd finished Wheeler and the one near Huntsville and Pickwick. Anyway, the only people who could condemn the equipment was the purchase department. I had a very good friend in the purchase department, and so one day at lunch we decided we'd go down to the warehouse and we'd open up one of those bottles that had crud around the top screw cap. It'd be crusty and everything, and so we condemned the whole thing. We got a couple of, at that time, they were building the earth fill for Chickamauga Dam. And dirt coming in. Took two big dump trucks and came down. He had loaded all that stuff up. And bear in mind, he had a lot of calomel and mercury and things in it, you know. And poured in that fill and covered it up. Well, I got rid of my drugs, but 6 months after we impounded Chickamauga Dam, all the fish in Halesbar Lake died. Why? But we put a lot of mercury in that.
Well, nobody ever knew, did they?
But getting back to the serious part of it, we did give and try to give good services, no question. And I think we did raise the level in some areas by giving the experience of the younger doctors to the older doctors. And of course, as we finished the dams, well, we closed up shop and decreased the number of, at one time I had, I think it was 38 doctors and 7 hospitals going at the same time, the small hospitals.
Yes.
But I was on the road practically the whole time.
In your work, in your position, did you have any connection with the malaria control program?
Yes. Walter Stromquist, a Swede, very brilliant. He was in our department. And he more or less revolutionized malaria control for dam-controlled rivers for water fluctuation. So simple. You would let the water go up to a certain level and you'd drop it back down halfway. You would strand the larva and they would die. Of course, we did the spraying and early mornings and all, but the water fluctuation, which was picked up not only in this country but worldwide for mosquito control.
Was he an MD or?
No.
He was an engineer.
He was a sanitary engineer. Mm-hmm. And a very good one. And
What do you recall, Doctor, the, just for the record, sort of, the really remarkable decrease in malaria over the period of how many years?
That I wouldn't know, Norman. I came from Alabama, and as a young boy, I would visit my grandparents up on the Cahaba River, where he had his water power. We had no screens at that time. We didn't know anything about mosquitoes. We knew they would bite, but no screens. And I would get bitten, and I would develop malaria. Chills and fever, tertiary type, every third day I would shake. And I can recall so well the rural doctor coming by on a horse with a pack saddle. He would come into the house, get to the kitchen table or where we ate, open his pack, pull out a vial of quinine powder, pull up a chart, he called it, a little piece of waxed paper, and he would pour out a certain amount, then he would take some empty capsules and fill it full, put the cap on it, and I would take X number a day. And about the fifth day, I would break out with the darndest rash you ever saw all over. In fact, my hands would peel like a cast. I was extremely sensitive to quinine. But that's all we had for malaria. Otherwise, I would die.
I doubt if they even connected your rash.
We didn't know. No. Yeah. Not until I went to see. Mm-hmm. While with TVA, I was sent to Hopkins and received my MPH, Master of Public Health. And at that time, I pretty well understood. Another thing happened back in my earlier days when I was doing chemical work before I went to medical school. At World War II, we developed in Birmingham the coke ovens in which we would extract the gases from the coal and make coke and take the gases and convert them into toluol and benzol and naphtha. And of course the toluol went into the TNT as an explosive at that time. And I was working as a chemist in a little control lab for those great big stills where we, at certain boiling points, we would cut off and make it four runnings, benzol, then toluol, and then naphtha. And we had little miniature stills in our laboratory where we could tell the still operator when to cut from one to the other by the percentage.
Yeah.
And we would wash the glassware with the what we would use there and everything, in our hands. I became acutely ill. Nephritis. I was unconscious for at least 10 days at home. I hadn't married, of course, then. And not until I went to Hopkins did I realize what had happened to me. That was benzoyl poisoning. The same thing that printers used to get when they would clean the type and all with it. But the mosquito, North Alabama was rampant at that time at Wheeler Dam and Wilson Dam, and it was pretty well controlled. And still is. We still fluctuate.
And there are practically no cases of malaria.
I diagnosed one case of malaria when I went to Signal Mountain in private practice. Boy on the mountain had been somewhere, I forgot where. Anyway, we did a blood smear, and the little gal in the laboratory said, "Dr. Langston, look at this slide." And there was that typical crescent shape. That was acute malaria. It was the only case I know of that we have on record at the Erlacher Hospital at that time.
That
pretty well answers your question about the frequency of the thing.
Yes. Were there any other medical advances in of this sort in TBA that you recall from your experience?
Well, silicosis is practically a thing of the past in the in that field by the research work we did and all, and the malaria control, and we did a lot with polio immunization and those things. We backed that up a great deal. And we did a lot toward in the state of Tennessee and others in pollution, the outdoor privies and things like that with typhoid and those things. But that was our health department control. The level of medical care I would say that over the span of years from 1933, between 25 and 30 years, that we participated in the golden age of medicine, you might say. Your antibiotics, your research, diabetes, heart, and everything, and also measles, communicable disease.
And immunization.
That's right. And by the combination of money spent through TVA and through the TVA's Health and Safety Department, working with the state agencies, county agencies, that we supported and implemented that advance to where it got down, you might say, to the people where it belonged. Now, in my Hopkins work, well, we could pretty well predict when we were going to have an epidemic by the cycle. Whenever the immunes were decreased to where there was others active, you'd get an epidemic in a wave. It would come in cycles like that. And we pretty well flattened those out in those areas. You don't hear anything about typhoid today or measles practically.
Yes.
Of course, we still have chicken pox, a few things. And following that area in time, now the next 25 to 50 years, I think, has been in the rapid advance heart surgery, transplants, you name it. Medicine moves so fast. Mm-hmm. It moves so fast to where we have reached the point of economic medicine, like I was talking yesterday. Specialization. In fact, when I had my acute abdomen, the ruptured gallbladder, followed by pulmonary edema, followed by heart failure, I had my regular doctor, an internist, I had a neurologist, I had a cardiologist, a cardiac surgeon, and the radiologist.
Renal, I guess somewhere in there would be a renal.
Yes, I had that. I had a urologist, what
yes,
I want to call it,
yes.
At my age, you know. But all those people have spent years and years of training. You take my son that's living in Memphis. He is a neuroradiologist. I can't even talk to him. He has done one or two cases like this. We used to have a thing known as little strokes in older people. They'd black out, come back. They were little tiny ruptures of the vessel, the artery in the brain. And then it would seal off, possibly, or not. Well, he has used great crazy glue in his radiological work. He takes a tiny catheter, starts down here and goes up, and locates where that little rupture was. And then he can inject one drop of the same substance we know as a crazy glue into that little catheter. And as soon as that crazy glue touches live blood or arterial blood, it seals off.
Well, remarkable advances. Well, you spent most of the years we've been talking about either in public health or institutional health until you left TVA and went into private practice.
On Signal Mountain.
On Signal Mountain. And this was in mid-40s, right?
Yeah, 47.
47. Well, what are your observations on the
on the shift from one field to the other, Doctor?
Well, the reason I left TVA, I had a good retirement income and everything if I just stayed with it. But I was put to a desk. I was through my contact with people, hospitals. All I was doing is pretty much just signing paper. And I just couldn't take it. And so I told my buddies like Bill Sheridan and Dr. Patterson and all around here I knew that I thought I would go to Signal Mountain and open an office. They said, Snow, you'll starve to death up there. I said, well, I'm going to try it. And I did. I resigned and took my retirement, opened an office. And it was interesting. My wife was very loyal. And I felt the age of specialization coming. And one of the reasons that I did, I was a member of First Baptist Church and had good friends. And I happened to be in Erlanger Hospitals one day, and I walked up to the emergency critical care. And walking down the hall, and I looked in a little anteroom there, and here was a friend of mine from the church, a lady, spoke to her, and another lady sitting there with her. And she said, this is Miss So-and-so, her husband's back in critical care. I stopped and visited, and this lady was also a member of the church. She said, Doctor, says my husband fell at home. He worked at one of the big companies here, was doing some night work by himself, and she was deaf and couldn't hear him, but he fell down the steps, critically injured, head, fractures and things. And she says, Doctor, my doctor in charge of his head says he's doing very well. The doctor in charge of this says he's doing very well, and so on and so forth. But how is my husband? You get the implication.
Yes.
And so often, after I went back on Signal Mountain, I would refer those things which I knew that I was not qualified to treat. But you take the neuro group at that time, they would alternate rounds each day, and you might see one day and one the next, and they would change orders and everything, and you didn't know who your doctor was. So, and when I would refer them, they say, now, will you come visit me? I said, yes. And I think one service that I rendered at Signal Mountain was that to interpret to the family and the patient what was going on.
To the total person.
Right. The total patient. And you talk about your divorce and family problems and everything. I could write a book on that mountain of the families up there, the West family and the Turnbull Cone family and all that. Those families crumbled. You saw it happen. You saw it happen on Lookout Mountain. You know what I'm talking about. And by keeping my confidence and listening, I often think I did much more good that way than I did by giving a bunch of pills to people. The human area of humanity, to a degree, we've lost it.
Right. Not only in this field, but in others, too.
And where are we heading down the road in this country? In philosophy of love. You know a lot more about that than I do, but you've seen it change. And your editorials have reflected, you know. But you and I, with our empathy for these things and things, we can't change the world. But maybe we can pass on to the younger generation. I still work with Boy Scouts. I think it's one of the best youth organizations I know. You don't have to be in a church to be a Boy Scout, but I think we have one of the finest areas here. I attended four national jamborees, slept on the ground. I love youth.